Horizon, an ultrasound scan of a baby in the womb.
Every mum wants their child to be normal. You wish the best for them. You hope that from that tiny little wonder they're going to go out and conquer the world. There should be nothing that at that tiny age that you should say, oh, you're not going to be able to do that. Something so bad had changed my child so significantly that it was going to affect her for the rest of her life. And she wasn't the only child.
In the 1990s, strange things began to happen in the small town of Corby.
As a mother, when anything's wrong with your child, you always think, is it me? Is it part of my family line? And then to think, well, we don't know what it is.
Mothers began to give birth to children with severe deformities.
We didn't actually realise how big this was. Because obviously, right around here, things like this don't happen.
As the number of cases grew, the mothers demanded to know why this had happened to their children.
I wasn't to blame. You were to blame for the way my daughter was born.
It made me so angry to realise how badly this situation had been handled. A toxic soup of dust hanging over a town.
This is the unknown story of the worst child poisoning case since thalidomide.
This was always going to be an uphill battle. It was almost like David and Goliath.
A case that changed our understanding of the dangers of air pollution.
Toxic town, the Corby poisonings. The tree-lined streets of Corby, Northamptonshire. Lisa Atkinson.
I lived in Corby. I'd taken a job in RS Components. We had to be up and on the work bus for like 5:30. And I remember feeling a little bit ropey a few times. I had this little line on my tummy. And I was at the doctor saying, well, what's this line? And he looked at me as if to say, you don't know why you're here? And I was like, no, I really don't. What's going on? And that's when he said, yeah, I was pregnant. And I was 6 months pregnant. So it left me very little time to prepare for the arrival of my little bundle of joy.
I always wanted twins, or at least two very close together. Leah was 2.5, so I thought the perfect age gap, wouldn't go into preschool, and then I just went back to work, and the same day I went back to work, I found out I was pregnant. It was slightly different, but I wasn't sure if that was from a girl to a boy. But suffering from migraines, just feeling more tired. Well, I thought maybe that's how you carry a boy.
I had Daniel when I was 26. It was great, you know, like just being a first-time mum and having a baby just there, and it was real. And like 2 years later, we decided to have another one. And Connor came along and just turned our worlds upside down.
All three mums lived within a few miles of each other and all had normal pregnancies, with nothing in their scans to suggest anything was wrong.
Went into labour early hours, and then I remember my husband noticed something wrong with the hands. His thumbs seemed to struggle, putting your finger in, then noticing that one stuck, and one was very, very tiny, like it wasn't attached to him. And I remember saying to the doctor when they come round, what's this? What's happened? So, oh, no, no, it's fine. It's just how they are formed in the womb. And I thought, oh, well, my daughter didn't have hands like that.
It wasn't till a few hours afterwards that I got to see her. And they said, she's fine, she's perfect, everything's fine, but she's only got three fingers on each hand. I remember thinking, OK, that's quite important. There was at least something that she was not ever going to be able to do. It became quite apparent really quickly that they were never going to give her another finger. They were never going to make it all right, and she was always going to have what she's got.
When Connor was born, they gave me him wrapped in a blanket and let me hold him and that, And I remember them saying something and Connor's dad was, like, very upset. But no one was telling me nothing. It's as if they were hiding something all the time. And the doctor came into the room and he said, you know, your baby's been born without any fingers on his left hand. And I was like, what do you mean, no fingers on his left hand? And he showed me, and it was really hard to deal with. I cried and I kept looking at it. Just had to deal with it, basically.
When anything's wrong with your child, you always think, was it me? Is it part of my family line? We don't know what it is.
They sit in silence.
Was it something I could have done differently? Was there something in my pregnancy in the early stages that I'd done wrong?
I knew I hadn't done anything wrong in pregnancy. I just wondered how.
They never gave you any answers. It's just sometimes Mother Nature doesn't get it quite right. And that was their explanation.
Soaring above the sleepy town with its rows of terraced houses in the shadow of an industrial estate, 1998.
In 1998, a journalist unexpectedly turned up on the mother's doorsteps.
Graham Hind from the Sunday Times. And he's come to the door and he says, are you Susan McIntyre? And I says, yes. He says, well, when you've got a son born with a hand defect, we think it's caused by toxic waste. I was thinking, what's toxic waste?
Graham Hind was working with fellow journalist Stephen Bevan on a mysterious story.
Graham Hind, he had this story about a group of mothers, all from the same quite small area, all of whom had given birth to children with very similar deformities.
As Stephen and Graham investigated, they uncovered even more children born with limb deformities.
The more Graham told me about it, the more I thought this was more than coincidence. There was a suspicion that there might be some links to toxic waste sites in the town. What was going on with these sites? What was in these sites?
Shimmering ponds.
The waste sites were located on land where the town's steelworks once stood.
Archive film of the steelworks.
Corby started life as a village, but in the 1930s, one of the largest steel plants in Europe was built.
The place is Corby, a steel town set in a sea of agriculture. Most of the men came from Scotland to work here. The giant British Steel Corporation plant dominates the skyline. Half the town's working population passes through its gates every day.
The Corby community was generated because of the steelworks, because it brought a lot of work. And so it was the hub of the town, really.
But in 1980, faced with huge government cuts, the steelworks shut down, leaving 11,000 people unemployed.
When the steelworks shut down, just Corby came to an end, really. They said it was a ghost town.
Corby Council devised a plan to regenerate the town.
It's not just about closing these works. The solution is about creating a new Corby.
This tiny council took on the biggest land reclamation project in Europe, with a 10-year regeneration programme to help bring Corby back to life. But demolishing a steelworks is a complex process. Steelmaking generates toxic waste that must be carefully disposed of.
A building's demolished.
There was a lot of activity going on to clear these sites and dumping it in these former steelwork dumps, particularly this large quarry site. Two of the mothers had been working near the same site when they fell pregnant. What was in this quarry and these other dumps? Could it be linked to these birth defects? It was just a powerful human story with a real element of mystery to it.
Despite repeated requests, the council refused to make any comment. But Stephen and Graham were undeterred.
You've got to remember, this is the paper that did thalidomide. 20 years earlier, it was a massive, groundbreaking story exposing the link between a sedative that had been prescribed to pregnant women and birth defects. One of the things about this story was its similarity to the thalidomide story.
After a year working on the case, Stephen and Graham were ready to go to press with a story suggesting the birth defects and the toxic waste sites were linked.
The photographer came round and took photos of Connor and photos of me, and it was just unbelievable, the amount of press. It's like a roller coaster.
When Connor Ford was born 2 years ago, the initial joy quickly turned to despair. He was born with a deformed hand.
All I want is answers. And if it is through toxic waste, there's got a lot of people to answer to this.
As this story spread, more and more mothers started coming forward.
The phone started ringing, and very quickly all these mums were starting to reveal that there's far more of these children around than we thought.
Earlier this week, we reported on a startling coincidence. Three young children born in the same area with similar hand defects. Since then, more cases have emerged.
With a swell of publicity, the number of cases was growing. Six children with limb deformities had now been identified, and the mothers wanted answers. Under mounting pressure, Corby Council commissioned the local health authority to investigate this cluster of birth defects. But the results of that investigation weren't what the families were expecting.
Dr. Patrick Morgan.
There is no evidence of a cluster in Corby. I would like to reassure them that living in Corby and having children in Corby, from the evidence that we have, is just as safe as having children in any other part of the county.
Threw the report straight across the room at them and just stormed out the meeting because I couldn't handle it anymore. Just couldn't listen to them. They were covered. It was like such a cover-up.
This is a very small town, and you're now sitting there telling me it's not a cluster. It was like someone was sitting you down in school and telling you this is what's happened, so you will accept that.
With the council claiming there was no evidence of a cluster, the mother's fight for answers seemed to be over.
They took us to a meeting, and I remember saying in the meeting, this is just a whitewash. They treated us like we were mums from Corby.
Des Collins, solicitor.
My first reading the article in the Sunday Times was complete happenstance. I was lighting a fire at home. I started tearing up bits of the Sunday Times to put in the fire, and then I see the word Corby. And I think, oh, that's interesting. I knew Corby and had, back in the day, worked in the steelworks. So I thought, well, I'll look at that. So I opened it up. If it hadn't been for my reading that article, I would never have been involved in it.
Intrigued by the story, Des Collins travelled to Corby to meet the mothers.
The mothers, whose names were in the Sunday Times, had been looking for some legal advice, but they were not sure what to do. They weren't thinking of suing at the time. They just wanted someone to look at it to see if anything had gone wrong. And that's why I became involved.
Des found us. He was like our captain. He kind of grouped us together and focused us, because that was what it was. We needed some focus.
The mothers were quite incensed. They thought they were being talked down to by the council, and that the report had been produced to make sure that the mothers gave up and went home.
Headlines read, new move in birth defects fight and toxic claim group starts court fight.
14 mothers had now come forward. Convinced they were being stonewalled, they enlisted Des to launch a legal case against Corby Council.
It's far beyond that which can be dismissed by way of coincidence. There's just too many people in such a small area. It may be difficult to prove, but it can be proved, and we, on behalf of the parents, intend to prove it.
Des had to prove that toxic waste from the steelworks had somehow damaged the babies in the womb, and that Corby Council had acted negligently during the regeneration works. But the council were unwilling to accept any blame.
There is no cluster. There is no causal link between the reclamation and the birth defects. And consequently, there is no case to answer.
Chris Mallander was appointed chief executive of Corby Council in 2003, and whilst in office continued to deny the mother's claims.
Our belief is there is no evidence whatsoever that anybody was exposed to a significant degree to anything nasty.
Corby was a close-knit town, and the accusations Des and the mothers were making were not well received.
You had a council populated by ex-steel workers, and they were hard-nosed guys and fully believed that these toxins can't do anything. We've worked with them for 30 years.
We've seen nothing yet to suggest that there is any link, however tenuous, between the reclamation programme and these defects.
Across atop a tall pillar, 2003.
Building a case to prove that toxic waste had poisoned the mothers was hugely complicated.
We wanted to prove that this had happened and it could be established in court. It had never been done before. And most people, including the council, said, "You're mad, you'll never do it."
To stand any chance of proving the council wrong, Des needed help.
The next stage of the process was to establish what went wrong. In order to establish that, we had to put in place a range of experts.
He assembled a land reclamation expert, a professor specialising in air pollution, and an expert on fetal development.
You get all the different disciplines working together as one, saying, yes, that can happen, that can happen, that can happen.
The first expert he consulted was an epidemiologist to establish if the health authority report was correct.
Epidemiology is the study of incidence of diseases in populations. How many cases of heart disease, all of that sort of thing, that's epidemiology. When I read the report, one of the things that struck me was that the approach had been coloured by their view that perhaps they didn't expect to find anything.
It seemed odd that so many birth defects had occurred in such a small town, yet the health authority's report concluded the statistics weren't above average. Professor Parker was immediately suspicious of how the figures had been calculated.
What Northamptonshire Health Authority did originally was they ascertained all of the cases of birth defects in the Kettering Health Authority area, and then they looked to see if the rate in Corby was higher than the rate in the whole of Kettering. But what they did was they calculated the rate in Corby and then compared that rate with the rate in the Kettering Health District, including Corby. So I didn't understand why they'd done that.
By including the figures from Corby, it appeared that the health authority had skewed the results.
So what I did was I looked at the rate of birth defects in Corby, and then I compared those with Kettering Health Authority excluding Corby. And what I found there was that the rate in Corby was not only high compared with Kettering, but it was high compared with the rest of Europe.
Professor Parker's calculations showed that during the land reclamation works from 1987 to 1999, the number of birth defects in Corby had almost tripled.
These children have been deformed. They will live with those deformities for years to come. If the council is liable, then it should put its hands up and say, sorry, we got it wrong, we will compensate you.
Professor Parker's report was a breakthrough, but the mothers still had a long legal battle ahead. And they were coping with their children's increasingly complex medical needs.
A man fills a kettle.
The idea, as far as I remember, was to graft a toe from my foot onto my hand to trial and see if they could use it as a finger.
Lewis put on my hands operation. He was just before he was one.
Slightly sold out for you.
So then he was in a high dependency unit with his toe in a bandage and obviously his hands as well for, I think, about 5 days. Anybody who has children in hospital, it's very, very hard. You know, it's very traumatic.
He makes himself a drink.
All I was told was my hands need fixing and this is the operation to do that. It's quite a scary thing for a young child to do. That was one of the first memories, going down in the operating theatre, mum and dad holding my hands.
The toe doctors grafted onto Lewis's hand didn't take. He had 4 major operations before the age of 12, but they all failed.
He was due to have another operation and Lewis just didn't want any more. I think he'd just gone through enough. And we learned to adapt that way. Yeah, so when it's traumatic enough, you have to say enough is enough.
News footage of Susan sitting with Connor on her lap, playing with the toy steering wheel.
Well, Connor had a thumb and little buds as fingers. He had 5 operations and 26 corrective surgery. First of all, they took the buds off and then they decided to do a toe transplant. So they took a toe off each foot and put it up to the hand. They at least they will have the grip to use to help him with things.
Susan helps Connor do a jigsaw. In an archive film called Corby Works, a crowd watches part of the steelworks being razed to the ground.
The next step in the case was to uncover how the council had managed the steelworks redevelopment.
We had to understand the way in which the reclamation programme had operated. The councils were very reluctant to disclose any information whatsoever.
I'm satisfied from an operational point of view that that was a well-managed programme. We used good contractors and it was a sound programme of activity.
Des repeatedly asked the council to hand over documents outlining how the reclamation was managed.
Families will be helped because we will know precisely what was in the tips and when that particular waste was moved, and we will then be able to determine how it was moved against a background of how we believe it should have been moved. We believe that's where the failings were.
His requests were refused.
An aerial view of a calm lagoon. 2004.
The council was always going to be reluctant to disclose information.
But then the case took a surprising turn.
We were scratching our heads one day when I came into the office and on my desk in a brown envelope was a lever arch file full of papers. It isn't normal for secret documents to turn up. It's like something out of a John Grisham novel. You think, you know, that he writes this stuff and I quite like reading it, but it doesn't happen in real life. But it did happen. We made further inquiries of the people who we knew in Corby, and it was indicated to us that a guy called Sam Hagen might have been responsible directly or indirectly for letting us see the papers.
A man's in a basement.
Sam Hagen worked for Corby Council for over 30 years. In the early 90s, he accused the council of taking shortcuts whilst redeveloping the steelworks, but his complaints were shut down. Years later, when Sam heard about the mother's case in the press, he dug out the information he'd gathered.
Here I've got a handwritten note, a mark strictly private and confidential, and it refers to a telephone call that I got on Saturday the 16th of March, 1995. And this guy identified himself as being a technical officer with the engineers department in the land reclamation. He was employed at supervising clearance of what is known as the toxic ponds. And the job was to empty these toxic ponds, clear this site, and they had a plan for doing that. The council officer that blew the whistle and told me that the practice that was going on, the safety regulations weren't being observed. They were playing fast and loose with it in order to do the job quicker and make money. And he decided there was nothing he could do internally, he had to tell somebody. Because this lad knew that if he was known as a whistleblower, he would lose his job. So he told me instead.
Sam anonymously passed on hundreds of documents, including the whistleblower's personal notebooks, to Des. It was a potential breakthrough, but it would take months to make sense of so many highly technical documents.
We're not land reclamation experts. If you show me a piece of work by a solicitor, can you say whether that's irredeemably incompetent? I can tell you, because I'm a solicitor, I can tell what should be done. But with a land reclamation, that is hugely technical stuff. So we're looking at this package and thinking, look, we found this thing. This is what's going to win or lose. But we don't know what's in it.
The legal case had now been running for over 6 years, and the families were facing new challenges as their children grew up.
While she's at home and she's only little, that's fine, because you're there to protect her. But, you know, soon enough, you have to let them go into the big wide world.
As the case intensified, Lisa's daughter Simone started secondary school.
What should have been the nicest part of your childhood probably turned out to be an absolute horror for her.
I would hide my hands all the time, and I would get the odd child asking me why my hands were like that. There was also a group of children that used to live behind us in the next street, and they would be picking on me a lot, and they would be shouting things from the alleyways, four fingers, or look at that four-fingered freak, and then run away from me. And I remember when I was old enough to walk to my dancing classes, I used to take myself the long way and make myself late for dancing because I didn't want to bump into the other children. Emotionally, mentally, it did affect me.
It changed her from being quite a gregarious, cheeky toddler to being quite a shy, introverted little girl. The older she got, she realised that the focus was her hands. So if people didn't see her hands, that would be okay.
It's not as if I've got eight fingers that look normal. They aren't normal, they don't look nice. Like, that's how I look at them. Maybe that's why I want to hide them all the time, because I don't want people to see them, because then I'm scared of what they're going to say.
It was a joy to have as a kid because nothing bothered him. He just got on with stuff, and then the bullying started when he was at school.
They say bad names about my hand. Like, two-finger freak.
He just didn't get peace from these children, calling him all sorts of names. Really horrible, the things they said. He got bullied that much that he used to break down and cry and say, "Mum, I don't want to go out because people are looking at my hand." He started biting his hand and didn't want it, tried to cut it off. But I think a lot was a cry for help. All Connor wanted was to be a normal kid and to grow up, to be a man and get on with his life. But no one ever gave him a chance.
We as a council have a huge degree of sympathy for the children and the families involved, but we see no evidence whatsoever to link the very serious deformities some of them suffer to the actual waste reclamation programme here in Corby. The implementation of the programme was exemplary. I just don't subscribe to this view that there was something terribly wrong with what was done at the time.
A headline reads, "A Legacy of Mystery." Roger Braithwaite, contaminated land specialist.
I am historically an environmental health officer. If I've got one area of expertise, it's contaminated land and environmental protection issues. Yes, it sounds a bit strange, doesn't it? How can you be passionate about contaminated land? But at the end of the day, the soil has got to be right.
Armed with the secret documents provided by Sam Hagen, Des Collins tracked down Roger Braithwaite, a leading expert in soil contamination.
I've got thousands of pages of stuff to read. Just on site investigation reports alone, I think I counted over 9,000 pages. What we were trying to establish was, were the wastes so badly handled that it resulted in a public nuisance which could potentially cause harm? And as time went on, I realised that there was most certainly a case to answer. Every process on a steelwork site involves lots of waste. And generally speaking, it's a toxic material. You end up with thousands and thousands of gallons of liquid waste that you have to put into lagoons. And these are known as settlement lagoons, became known as toxic ponds. Liquid wastes are the most difficult things to deal with.
Steel is made from iron ore, and during the manufacturing process, produces a number of toxic chemicals. These include arsenic, cyanides, mercury, and cadmium. Many of these chemicals are disposed of in waste ponds.
Footage of the steelworks.
Now, this was the biggest and most complex development of its kind in the whole of Europe. So, needless to say, the people from the government decided to go and take a look. I found a letter from the then head of environmental health. He wrote to the planning officer and he said, these are the chemicals which we would expect. He identified all the chemicals that he thought might have arisen as a result of the waste, and they offered advice.
The advice included that the contractors cover their lorries and make sure no dust was created, particularly on public roads.
Every bit of advice that they got from these experts, they just ignored. Lorries weren't covered. It's all just draining out of the back of these dump trucks. And all the haul roads in the area are just covered in this silt. And that's where everything went pear-shaped.
Each of the mothers lived or worked within a few kilometres of the routes these trucks were taking.
A rear light flashes.
You would always hear the trucks going backwards and forwards when they were moving the mud. So it was just sludge.
I used to walk to my mum's every day, and there used to be a lot of trucks passing us with soil falling on the road, and get on my pram wheels that Daniel was in, and I was pregnant with Connor at the time. God knows what we were washing off. You know when you're at the seaside and you go back to your car and there's like sand all over the windscreen? That's what it was like, but it was a like orangey red dust.
My husband would come home from work and his clothes would be a little bit more dirtier than usual. We used to say just take them off in the porch and then put them in the washing machine, separate from everybody else's clothes.
The work was done so amateurishly, in effect, just basically muck shifting without any controls whatsoever. The key thing about that sludge, very, very fine particles. It would have resulted in a tremendous amount of pollution over the whole of the district. That is just basically a toxic soup of dust hanging over a town.
Wipers clear dust from a windscreen.
Now, this is not happening in 1 week or in 1 month or even 1 year. It's happening over many, many years.
Rogers on his laptop.
After months examining the documents, Roger was certain that the council's mismanagement of the dangerous toxins had put the people of Corby at risk.
Roger's report, titled Contamination Issues Relating to the Old Corby Steelworks and Associated Waste Disposal Areas.
There was a few days, quite a few days, where, especially on a hot sunny day,
you'd be in the office and you'd just see it was like you're in the Sahara Desert. It's like a sandstorm coming along. So we used to shut the windows. And you go out to your car and it was literally as though you'd driven through the desert.
Tracy Taylor worked in accounts in an industrial estate, right next to the route the contractors used to transport the toxic waste.
When our daughter was born, she'd got a deformed ear.
A photo of Tracy's baby.
And, you know, they sort of said, oh, don't worry about it, it's probably just how she's laid, we'll get ENT to have a look at it. We seemed to be the happy little family. Noticed Shelby didn't seem to be wanting to eat or drink or move a lot. She wouldn't feed. Doctor came up, took her down for loads of scans. All her internal organs were deformed.
A photo of baby Shelby lying on a hospital bed.
They did say they could try to operate, but the first operation they gave a 5% chance of coming out alive, which we didn't think was fair. So we agreed what we'd do is take her off life support. Within 5 minutes, she'd gone. She passed in her arms. Like most new mums, you've lost a child, you tend to blame yourself, ask yourself, was it something I'd done? There's a death certificate showing that she died at the John Radcliffe Hospital.
Tracy takes Shelby's death certificate out of a ring binder and reads it.
After she died, we had a meeting with them to find out why Shelby's internal organs were like they were. And we were asked if either of us worked with toxic waste or chemicals, because that was really the only thing that would sort of cause them internal deformities. At the time, obviously, we both said no because we didn't realise either of us had been in contact with any.
A photo of Tracy and her partner gazing tenderly down at Shelby, who's cradled in her arms. News footage of Lisa, her daughter Simone, and Susan.
I always used to think, oh, maybe someone's got it wrong. Like, maybe the council are right. Surely the council couldn't have done something that bad and that careless to affect so many people out there. My mum's a fighter. It might have took a toll on her, but she'd never show that. I wonder what it was like for her in the early stages. Whether she actually thought that she'd done something wrong to make me the way I was. She had so many questions and never got the answers.
Des is poring over a document in a binder.
We were trying to establish that airborne contamination could affect the fetus. If you inhaled the material, then it could cause limb defects.
Des now had expert evidence showing that toxic dust was in the air in Corby whilst the mothers were pregnant. But there was a further challenge. Nobody had ever proved that mothers breathing in toxins could damage a fetus.
It just wasn't something which anyone had tried to show. Tried and failed. No one had even tried.
David Penman, gynaecologist.
Most of my work is detecting abnormalities, and I'd done quite a lot of research into birth defects when I was approached about this case. And having established that there was a greater number of these cases born in the population in and around Corby than one would expect from national figures, it seemed only reasonable that there has to be an explanation. Why?
Dr. Penman started by investigating the list of toxins that are produced during the steelmaking process.
I had to work through each one to try and find any published literature that showed that they were capable of causing these or similar defects inhaled as fine particles. I often spent weeks and weeks coming across one paper after another that I thought was going to give us some good evidence. Often as not, it tended to be a blind alley.
After months of searching, Dr. Penman finally had a breakthrough.
We know that smokers have higher blood cadmium levels because of the cadmium absorbed from cigarette smoke. And so I trawled the world literature for any evidence of a greater incidence of limb reduction defects in smokers. An NHS Commission study on cadmium showed that in mice and rats that it is capable of causing limb reduction defects. And that was really critical here, because this is the sort of defect that most of these children born in Corby had. Cadmium seemed to be the prime suspect.
A baby's limbs develop in the first trimester of pregnancy. Dr. Penman discovered that when inhaled, cadmium can get into the bloodstream of the mother and thus interrupt the formation of the limbs.
That was just a wonderful moment. We really did seem to have a smoking gun pointing at cadmium.
Telephone wires. A car drives past Dean House, a Corby Borough Council building. 2007.
8 years after the case began, the evidence against the council was stacking up. But there was one big question the team still had to crack. They needed to prove that the toxic dust could have travelled far enough to reach all of the mothers.
It wasn't a question of whether it could go into the air. It was a question of, once it was in the air, how far it could travel. That is hugely technical stuff. It had never been established before, but that doesn't mean it can't be done, because someone's always got to do something for the first time.
Dust particles, to most people, are just a nuisance around the house. To me, they are extremely complicated scientific phenomenon.
Tony Cox is an air pollution expert who had worked on other high-profile industrial disaster cases. He was asked to prove whether the toxic particles could have travelled up to 3 kilometres to reach the mothers.
Those particles that we can breathe into our lungs, they are likely also to travel a long way in the air. But obviously I had the challenge of proving that to a judge. I did some calculations and I produced a little table. And that table suggested that particles that were capable of being breathed would travel easily far enough to reach the location of any home in Corby.
With this final piece of evidence, the team were almost ready to go to trial. But then came a problem that threatened the whole case.
I subsequently got the defendant's evidence, which concluded that all the particles would fall out of the atmosphere. I think the figure was 1.5 kilometres. Well, several of the claimant houses were actually further than 1.5 kilometres from the source of the emissions. There was a quite glaring difference between their findings and mine. I tried to reproduce their results, and I found I couldn't reproduce them. And I checked my equations very carefully. I checked the equations that they said they were using, and everything seemed correct, and yet the answers were different.
The defendant's evidence contradicted Professor Cox's. If their calculations were correct, the dust couldn't have travelled far enough to affect all the mothers. Worried about the discrepancy, Des confronted Tony.
There was a great deal of tension. Des is a man who's quite prepared to take on a risk. But of course, he's got a lot at stake if it doesn't go right.
Despite this difference between the two experts' evidence, Des had no choice but to move forward.
All we could do was rely on the view given by Tony Cox. At that stage, we were prepared to rely on it.
After a 9-year battle, 18 families were now involved in the fight for compensation, and they were finally ready to go to trial.
We had to get a barrister in place. We put together this package and sent it to half a dozen very important barristers and said, you have been put into this shortlist, and if you're lucky, you'll get this job. And I think three of them came back to get last.
I wouldn't have wanted to be part of a beauty parade. Either you want me or you don't want me. I'm a blunt Yorkshireman, so... My main areas I worked in were clinical negligence, which is claims on behalf of children who'd been damaged at birth. And you only had to meet the families to realise how they felt that they'd been let down by the system, because this was Corby Council and they were effectively what people regard as respectable, that they must be right and they must be wrong.
With a difficult trial ahead of them, Des made a final attempt to strike a deal with Corby Council.
In order to avoid the trial, we put an offer to the council to see whether it would settle. But the council wouldn't look at it. They were convinced that they would succeed at trial. At that stage, they had the bit between their teeth and they couldn't wait to get into court.
The experts have studied all the medical evidence and so on, and they've concluded likewise that there is nothing to link what we did with the cases that have been found.
2009.
A group of people who believe their birth defects were caused by their mothers being exposed to toxic materials have taken their case to the High Court.
I've had to live with it for 19 years, haven't I? I've been bullied throughout my life. I want some answers, and I want to know why I'm like this, and I've had to go through this.
On the 16th of February 2009, after years of gathering evidence, it was finally time for the mother's team to battle the council in court, fighting to prove a case that had never been proven before.
It was just like this little group of, like an army, just literally like, let's go forward, let's have it.
People board a bus.
10 years after their battle began, all 18 mothers made their way to court.
Arriving together at the Technology and Construction Division of the High Court this morning, the families are hoping the 3-month trial will allow them to seek damages of up to £1 million each.
They weren't just there to watch proceedings. David Wilby called them as his first witnesses.
I'm stood up in this court thinking, OK, there's our team there. Then there's these council people sitting in front of me with utter arrogance written all over their faces.
The mothers were given the first chance to tell somebody in authority what had actually happened. I think the aspect of their evidence which is important was their fairly graphic evidence about how dirty Corby was during the time that these reclamation works took place.
I was confident in my answers. But I did it with steely determination.
I wanted the families who had been saying this for so long to actually be believed and recognised.
It was good in a way to say your little story. That in itself just makes you so strong.
What kept us all going was the fact that we knew we were doing right and we had to do this for the children.
In response, the council's defence team argued that the children's deformities were just an unfortunate coincidence.
And I remember standing there and them asking me the most ridiculous questions. Honestly, I think they were trying to say that whatever happened to my baby happened due to something either genetically or something I did in my childhood.
Everything we done, everything we said was a challenge. It was like, no, this can't be happening. This is just coincidence.
It was a very daunting day, just being in front of someone just firing questions at you as though you've done something wrong, you know, when all you've done is give birth.
What you were able to do was to support their accounts with objective evidence from the time. And, of course, this made a big difference because the judge knew they were telling the truth. nobody who was in court on a number of the days could have come away other than being very impressed by them.
Mums are a force to be reckoned with in any world, regardless of whether your child has got deformities in their hands or not.
When that evidence finished, I think we felt as well that was a good start.
Following the mother's evidence, each side called their expert witnesses. The defence grilled Roger Braithwaite, denying negligence and arguing that the waste material wasn't dangerously toxic.
This was a lot of pressure. I was in the witness box for 3.5 days. The whole process was arduous. The fundamental aspect of the defence was there wasn't the degree of contaminants there that we said that there would be. And they made a big point about the fact that people working on the site were all right. You know, I'm not sure how many pregnant mothers were working, doing the reclamation work.
Roger's gruelling cross-examination left Des and his team concerned.
You get a week into the trial and you think, where is this going? It's at that moment when you come down to earth and suddenly think, this could go so badly wrong. And what will happen if it does go wrong?
During the course of the trial, the judge visited Corby to see the reclamation site for himself.
Mr. Justice Aikenhead traced the haulage route of the lorries that carried the contaminated ground away.
Afterwards, the judge honed in on the issue of how far the dust could travel.
The important link in the case was this question of how the dust got to the mothers. They were relying on the fact it couldn't get there as their main backup defence.
The judge demanded the parties resolve the differences in their calculations before the next day's proceedings.
Once I'd really exhausted all my efforts to find something wrong in my own calculations, I thought I'd better have a look more closely at the foundation of the calculations that were presented by the defendant experts. And so I had a good look at this equation, and I found that the defendants had not done their own calculations. All their results had been derived from a German scientist. And when I realised that, I knew I had to get the German paper.
It was clear that if Tony's evidence was to be accepted, that we had to get hold of that German report and we had to get hold of it within a space of a day.
After trawling through thousands of documents, Des's team finally found the German report.
When I got the paper, the equation was different. They had made a mistake. Part of a mathematical equation had been missed. And I then knew what the cause was of the difference in the results between myself and the defendants.
That meant that the distance that the dust could travel was 2, 3, 4 kilometres. It was a major turning point because it meant that we could prove that the dust had got from where Corby were working into the lungs of the mothers, into the blood of the babies in the womb, and could have caused the damage that the children unfortunately suffered.
A grand building.
In April 2009, barristers for each side made their closing speeches. And Mr. Justice Aikenhead left to consider his decision.
It was always to get some answers. Because it's all well and good saying, oh, me as a mum, I'm strong and I brought my daughter up to be, you know, independent. But without answers, that really means nothing.
We sat down with them all and said, this is very difficult litigation. We might lose. In fact, accepted wisdom is we will lose. If a lawyer tells me they've never lost a case in their life, what I say to them, you haven't fought enough difficult cases.
30 seconds to it.
Because if you fight difficult cases,
go out on a limb, you will lose sometimes.
Good evening and welcome to the BBC News at 6. They were all born with disfigured hands or feet, and their childhoods were disfigured as a result. But today, 16 children and their families won a landmark legal battle.
The judge said today the council had been negligent and that that negligence was likely to have harmed those unborn children.
Within these 400 pages is confirmation of what so many families have believed for so long.
We didn't actually realise how big the case was, because obviously, like, round here, things like this don't happen.
They are going back to Corby tonight, bolstered, upbeat, smiling.
You're part of history. It's just absolutely fantastic. You're just so happy and then you just don't know what to do next because it's kind of all over and it's like, wow, I feel like I can take on the world.
I now have a reason. I could confidently say to Simone, these are the reasons you are the way you are, and now you've got them reasons to pass on to your children.
Not only we won, there were 30 issues, and we'd won every one of the 30 issues, one by one by one. And the elation was palpable.
I think the judgment was 90-odd pages or 100-odd pages, but all you keep doing is reading the last page. They had shown the council that they had been right all the way through, that someone had done something awful to them, and they had done right by their children.
Although disputing the outcome, Corby Council agreed to pay compensation to all 18 children. They were hit with a legal bill of almost £15 million. It was the first case in the world to rule that air pollution could harm babies in the womb.
The case of the children in Corby will be a benchmark for future issues. I take pride in that it will help people. Sorry. Do I think that this will be the last time we ever see a case like this? Probably not. I think we're too nonchalant about the way we do things. It shouldn't have to really come to that. I think we need to be more careful.
A crowd watches the steelworks get demolished. After graduating with a degree in biology, Lewis now lectures in epidemiology.
Relating to the case, it does make you think, is there more to this in terms of long-term impacts? Can it lead to things like cancer? In terms of future, for me, it's quite a worry sometimes.
Connor was 12 when the trial finished.
Connor got his money at 18 and he got involved in a lot of drugs to make his life easier, but it was all wrong. He ended up doing 3.5 years in prison. He's 2 years out now, so he's doing well for himself now.
Soon after the trial ended, Simone gave birth to a daughter, Eva Marie.
My confidence came as I got older, and more so when I had Eva Marie.
She is a really good mum. She's done a good job. She's a little bit overprotective, but, yeah, aren't all mums.